Well, hello there, ladies and gentlemen. The MSS crew is back, and thanking you for joining us here in the Fred Bertelsen Memorial Old Time Radio Room of RadioOutOfThePast.org. The day's date is Saturday, October 10th, 2015, and this is your MSS host, Luis Jr., assisting with bringing to you yet another exciting and exhilarating internet broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. We've got another round of OTR surprises coming your way. All you need to do is stick around for a little while and join us while we hit the button in the studio and get these things rolling. So, if you would all just allow me a moment to introduce the presenter for tonight's program. Just so happens to be a very popular voice around the old-time radio room and accessible world, and you might know who I'm talking about, Joy Jackson. Yes, the librarian is back, and she's put together another show for your listening enjoyment. As always, I would just ask if everyone could please sit back, grab your favorite drinks and snacks, and enjoy the program. Okay, Joy, the microphone is yours. Take it away.
Thanks, Louise. Welcome to another MSS edition of Treasures Old and New from ART. I'd like to start off with ART's first recording of Chuck Wagon Tales, which was a series out of San Francisco. Here's Ghost Town. We kind of ran out of time, so I want all my cast to think you've just walked into the radio studio and an assistant producer came running out and grabbed all five of you to do this show, cold.
The American Radio Theater presents Ghost Town, the first episode of Chuck Wagon Tales from June 20th, 1948.
Charlie James ran a sun-beaten hand over his face. It was caked with dust, and his lips were hard and cracked. He lifted his eyes slowly, and he ran them around the horizon. Sand, mile after mile of brown sand, seemed to quiver under the burning rays of the sun. Charlie shook his head. It was the soul-withering desert, and Charlie was faced with the unalterable fact that, through no fault of his own, he was afoot in the fiery heart of it.
And so begins Ghost Town, the first exciting story in a new series of Chuck Wagon Tales, brought to you each Sunday at this time by H. Moffat Company of San Francisco, producers of extra fine, extra rich, manteca-fed beef.
It had been about 9:30 in the morning that Charlie James Pinto had stumbled on a hillock of hard dirt in the middle of Desert Valley, and he'd fallen forward, pitching him headlong into the soft dirt. It had been 10:30 when Charlie had finally given up hope of saving the horse, and he'd sent a merciful bullet crashing through the beast's head. It was 11 when Charlie first fully realized what had happened, and was able to throw the saddle sack and canteen over his shoulder and begin trudging forward. Toward where? Somewhere out here to the east, by the low ledge hardly visible in the distance, was his destination, East Mesa. They'd warned him not to attempt the trip to East Mesa alone, but Charlie James was not one to fear nature's most deadly traps. So Charlie started on his Pinto. For a full day, he'd pushed through the barren sands and till at last the sun had finished its slow swing across the sky, and night brought brief respite from the heat. Before dawn on this second day, he'd started again, and he'd been making good progress until... Charlie shook his head. He didn't want to think about it. Losing his horse any place would have been bad enough, but being set afoot in this place was enough to bring on madness without the help of the sun. And madness was the thing to be feared most of all. He had water enough for one, maybe 2 days, Food for three or four, but only if he conserved it and made every drop and every morsel give him strength for his long trek. Charlie was plodding along slowly when suddenly he thought he heard something and he stopped short. He listened, but there was no sound. No sound at all. Not even the slightest stirring of a wisp of breeze. The sand burned his feet through the soles of his shoes when he was standing still. So he began pushing on again. And then he was sure he heard it again. Yes, 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 there were footsteps. Footsteps. Pounding, pounding, crunching, crunching, pounding through the sand. Strange how loud a single sound became in an otherwise sound of his own footsteps, amplified by a trick of the mind until they became like the trampling of 100 feet. A trick of the mind. A trick of the mind. In just a moment before he determined that if he died, it wouldn't be through madness. The hottest part of the day was gone, and he was still alive, still moving forward. There was always an off chance that a little movement of air would spring up, and the still less likely possibility that someone would happen along. The sun was beginning to lean toward the west when Charlie's hazy vision fell on something that made his eyes widen. Ahead of him, on the ground, slanted off into a hollow, and above the crest of sand appeared the flat front of a building. Charlie had heard too much about desert visions to start toward it on the run. But instead, he kept his eyes on the spot, and he kept moving forward at the same pace. As he approached, another roof came into sight, and then several more. This was no mirage. It was a town. He'd come out of the desert alive. Charlie tossed the saddle sack off his back, and he swung the canteen down, lifted it to his lips, and drained its contents. Then he started at a fast pace. He came across what had once been a wagon trail, and he followed it along toward the town. He found a sign along the way, a sign covered with brown dust. He wiped it off with his hand.
Gilpatrick.
Charlie had never heard of a town by that name, but that didn't matter. He staggered past the first building and into what appeared to be the main street. Slanting rays of the sun fell on dusty gray buildings and slipped through the gaping holes that had once been windows. Charlie mustered enough voice to call out,
"Hey!"
There was no answer. The town was deserted. Charlie staggered to the nearest door and he pushed it open, and he fell to the floor in sheer exhaustion. It was dark when he awoke, dark and cool. His muscles were still aching and his feet still throbbing, but it was cool. And at that moment, that was all that seemed important. He reached for his canteen and was about to open it when he remembered, empty. He'd spilled all the water down his throat when first he was sure that he'd reached a town. A town. He might as well have been out under the cactus. On the remote chance that he might find water somewhere, Charlie struggled to his feet and he began a search. He combed every inch of the place, haunted through every building. But it was no use. Nowhere in the whole shell of what had once been a town could he find the tiniest drop of moisture or a single crumb of food. At last he slumped down on a broken step and he buried his face in his hands.
Ghost town! I get out of the desert. Now I'm going to die in a ghost town.
Who says you're going to die?
Charlie looked up quickly. The rays of the moon fell on a stooped figure standing before him. In his amazement, Charlie jumped to his feet and he spoke quickly.
Who are you? How did you get here?
I live here.
But where were you? I looked through every building.
So you think I'm a ghost? Ever ghost town ought to ever ghost, huh? Yeah, so you tried to lick the desert, eh? Well, reckon what you want most is a drink of water, huh?
Charlie nodded his head quickly. Speaking again would be too much of a strain. The old man lumbered along, beckoning him to follow. And when they'd reached the centermost building along the single street of the town, the stranger stopped and he pointed.
In here.
But there ain't any water in there. I searched the place.
Y'all searched, did you? Well, that's good. Let me show you.
They went inside. The building had once been a store, and the old man led the way behind a counter. Beneath it was a trap door, a door that led down a rickety pair of stairs and into a chamber below. The walls were of wood, propped up to keep the soft dirt from falling in. The old man had lighted a lantern, and as Charlie's eyes became accustomed to the light, he could see. From between the boards on one side, a tiny stream of water trickled into a barrel below. He asked no questions, but he leaped for it and he appeased his thirst. When he's finished finally drinking, the stranger tossed a gesture toward a large tin box in the corner. Charlie opened it, and he found it was filled with food. Dried out food, but food. After gnawing at a few crusts and resting in the coolness of the basement, Charlie felt better. He turned to his strange host, who crouched in the shadows in the corner.
I don't know who you are, partner, but you sure saved my life.
Yeah. I saved your life, didn't I, huh? Now I'm even. I took one. I saved one.
You took one?
Surprised, ain't you? Yeah. Oh, I murdered a man for his gold. Maybe 10-15 years ago. I've been hiding here ever since. Ah, I wish you could have seen all the times they come out to look for me. Been here to kill Patrick 100 times, but I had out. I hide out down here, and it took them 10, maybe 15 years to find me.
But they did find you?
Yep, they found me about 2 weeks ago. Took me into town to try me.
Then you must have escaped.
I'm here again. Can't keep old Dan away from Gilpatrick for long.
But how?
Oh, you're wondering how I could live out here for all this time? It's easy. Plenty of water for one or two men lease out into this barrel. And then the only work one got to do is go into East Mesa once a month when it's moonlight to steal some food. You can live here with me if you want.
If I want to?
Live here all your life. You don't have to do nothing unless you want, except to stealing some food.
No, thanks. I got to be getting to East Mesa. I think I can make it all right from here.
Oh, sure you can make it. Easy trip from here. There'll be enough moon tomorrow night. It's easy if you travel at night. Well, if you're going, you better get some sleep.
It was nearly morning when Charlie curled up and old Dan left him to sleep in a cool of the cellar. And it was dark again when old Dan stirred him and told him it was time to leave. Charlie gathered his things together painfully, swallowed a few more dry crusts and all the water he could drink, and then following Dan out to the edge of town. The old man pointed to a tall mesa silhouetted against the rising moon in the distance.
You head for that, son, and you can't miss. When you get to town, you all tell him that old Dan saved your life. He took one, and he saved one. He saved one. That'll give him a start.
Toward the middle of the morning, he walked into East Mesa. Several of the townspeople gathered around him when they learned that he'd crossed the desert by foot. Charlie felt that this was the right time to acknowledge his debt to Dan.
I'd never come out alive if it hadn't been for old Dan at Gilpatrick.
Old Dan, you say? How long ago was you at Gilpatrick?
But just last night.
Oh, my lands. Better come with me, son. You need rest. Bad.
Wait a minute. What's the matter? What are you looking at me so funny for?
Well, son, you see, we tried old Dan for murder here last week.
I know that. He told me, but he's back in Gilpatrick now.
We tried old Dan for murder and found him guilty. He died dangling from a noose 5 days ago.
American Radio Theater has presented Ghost Town, the first episode of Chuckwagon Tales, produced and directed by Joy Jackson. It was originally broadcast in San Francisco on June 20th, 1948. In our cast, you heard Dave Barker as Frank, Pat McNally as Charlie, Renaud Leboeuf as the old man, and Esther Geddes McVeigh as the lady. Sound effects by Fenny Swanberg, engineering by Ron Ailey and Mike Wheeler. Additional music by Kevin MacLeod. www.incompetech.com. I'm your announcer, Bob Hutchison, and this is ART, the American Radio Theater.
My next show is one of the Professor Challenger tales, adapted from an Arthur Conan Doyle story. Here is Cole Hornaday as Professor Challenger in When the World Screamed. American Radio Theater presents When the World Screamed, a Professor Challenger adventure written by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and adapted for radio by Cole Hornaday.
My God, Jones, look there. The walls are expanding.
Come on, Ted. This may be a race for our lives. Had that wager reached the surface before this shaft collapses.
The Academy of Sciences will tread lightly about Challenger from this day forward.
I fear it will be the whole human race who treads lightly. I had a vague recollection of having heard my friend, Edward Malone of the Gazette, speak of Professor Challenger, with whom he had been associated in some remarkable adventures. My general recollection was that Challenger had been depicted as a wild genius of a violent and intolerant disposition. Therefore, I was greatly surprised to receive a business communication from him.
My dear Peerless Jones, I have occasion to engage the services of an expert in artesian borings. I will not conceal from you that my opinion of experts is not a high one. Nonetheless, I am disposed to give you a trial. Looking down the list of artesian authorities, the almost certain oddity of your name attracted my attention. I found upon further inquiry you are acquainted with my young friend, Mr. Edward Malone. I can say no more than this is a matter of extreme secrecy. Interview with me Friday next at 10:30 a.m. My standard, you shall find, is no mean one. There is a scraper as well as a mat, and Mrs. Challenger is most particular.
I responded with all due haste, with a perfectly civil business note. Your letter, undated, has been received, and I look forward to meeting with you on Friday next. To which I drew this second epistle as though written in barbed wire.
Sir, I observe that you nitpick upon the trifle that my letter was undated. Might I draw your attention to the fact that, as some return for a monstrous taxation, our government is in the habit of affixing a small circular sign or stamp upon the outside of the envelope which notifies the date of posting. Should this sign be missing or illegible, your remedy lies with the proper postal authorities. Meanwhile, I would ask that you confine such observations to matters that concern the business over which I consult you.
Clearly I was dealing with a lunatic. Before further interaction escalated to tragic proportions, I thought it best to consult my friend Malone.
A That's nothing, my boy. You'll feel as if you've been skinned alive after being with him for 5 minutes. He's matchless for defensiveness.
Then why should the world put up with it?
They don't. He collects all the libel suits and all the rows and all the police assaults.
Assaults?
Bless you. He could think nothing of throwing you downstairs to conclude a disagreement. He's a primitive caveman in a lounge suit. I can see him with a club in one hand and a jagged bit of flint in the other. Some people are born out of their proper century, but he's born out of his proper millennium. He belongs to the early Neolithic or thereabouts.
And he's a professor.
Well, there is the wonder of it. He's the greatest brain in Europe with a driving force behind it that can turn all his dreams to facts. They can do all they can to hold him back, for his colleagues hate him like a poison. But a lot of trawlers might as well hold back the Berengara. He simply ignores them and steams on his way.
Well, one thing is clear. I don't want to have anything to do with him. I'll cancel my appointment.
You'll do no such thing. You will keep it to the minute. And mind, that is to the minute, or you will hear of it.
Why should I? Keep the appointment, that is.
Don't take it seriously. What I've said about old Challenger, well, everyone who gets close to him learns to love him. There's no real harm in the old bear. Why, I remember how he carried an Indian baby with the smallpox on his back for 100 miles from backcountry down to the Madeira River. He's big in every way. He won't hurt you if you get right with him.
I won't give him the chance.
You'll be a fool if you don't. Have you ever heard of the Hengist Down mystery?
The shaft sinking taking place on the south coast? Some secret coal mining exploration, I understand.
Perhaps. But he's fenced off the gully as well as the neighbouring estate. Bloodhounds guarding the place. Several pressmen have nearly lost their lives, to say nothing of the seats of their trousers. Oh, it's a big operation, but each operator has been sworn to secrecy. Challenger is down to the last stages of his plan, and clearly an artesian help is needed. Now, would you be not foolish to refuse a job that would garner such exposure? My experience, to say nothing of rubbing shoulders with the most wonderful man you have ever met or are likely to meet.
You're as much the fawning psychophant as he is the madman.
Not to mention the fat check at the chore's end.
There is that as that. And Friday morning found me before Challenger's doorstep at Fenmore Gardens. I'd taken such particular care to be on time that I was 20 minutes early. As my foot struck the marble of the first step, who should burst through the door but an old acquaintance of mine from the modem firm, Jack Devonshire.
That caustic throwback to knuckle-dragging nomads?
Jack was known to be the most subdued
and must-ridden.
Never out of proper deportment.
Hirsute barbarian?
It was therefore a shock to find him peppered in something strongly resembling boiled egg white.
Damn him.
What's up, Jack? Are you in on this job, too?
God save it, Peerless Jones.
Is the professor not seeing anyone?
Oh, he'll see you all right if you've got the proper appointment.
I take it you are tardy.
I came to retrieve payment.
You can't get your money.
Oh, he's very open-handed with the money. I'll give the old gorilla the justice of saying that much. But he pays when he likes and how he likes. I've got laborers to pay. When I called upon him, the butler's message was only, "The professor desired me to say, sir, that he was rather busy at the present eating an egg, that if you would call at a more convenient time, he would very likely see you."
But you persisted.
I and was served accordingly.
Wasn't for you, old boy. The professor's a 5-minute egg man. Jack and I parted ways by firm, if not spongy, handshake. Now it was my turn upon the anvil.
Mr. Peerless Jones, 10:30. Everything is in order. We have to be careful, Mr. Jones, for we are much annoyed by journalists. The professor, as you may be aware, does not approve of the press. Professor will see you now, sir.
In the next instant, I found myself in the presence of Professor Challenger. My friend Ted Malone had described the man in his Lost World yarn far better than I could hope to, so I'll leave it at that. All I was aware of was a huge trunk of a man behind a mahogany desk, with a great spade-shaped black beard and two large gray eyes half-covered with insolent, drooping eyelids. His big head sloped back, His beard bristled forward, and his whole appearance conveyed one single impression of arrogant intolerance. He stared up like a stalking bear. I laid my card upon his desk.
Of course. You are the expert, so-called Mr. Jones. Mr. Peerless Jones. Well, you may thank your godfather, Mr. Jones, for it was his ludicrous prefix that drew my attention to you.
I'm here, Professor Challenger, for a business interview and not to discuss my lineage.
Oh, dear me. You seem to be a very touchy person, Mr. Jones. Your nerves are in a highly irritable condition. We must walk warily in dealing with you, Mr. Jones. Are you married, sir?
What? No, sir, I...
Capital. Then it shall be that much easier for you to keep a secret.
Sir?
Pray, sit down and compose yourself, for I need your utmost attention for what I'm to share. I am not a man taken to repetition. I'm engaged just now in a great experiment. I may even say the greatest experiment in the history of the world, and I ask for your participation.
I shall be honored, sir.
Indeed, it is an honor. Now, Mr. Jones, having obtained your promise of inviolable secrecy...
Inviolable? But, sir, I
come down to my essential point. It is this. The world upon which we live is itself a living organism.
My suspicions were correct. This man was nothing short of a lunatic.
Your brain, as I observe, Mr. Jones, fails to register, but it will gradually absorb the idea. You will recall how a moor or heath resembles the hairy hide of a giant animal. You will then consider the secular rise and fall of land, which indicates the slow respiration of the creature. Finally, you will note the fidgetings and scratchings which appear to our Lilliputian perceptions as earthquakes and convulsions.
Barking mad, most assuredly. My brain whirled as I tried to find some answer to these monstrous contentions. But the temperature... Is it not a fact that it rises rapidly as one descends, and that the center of the earth is liquid heat?
You are probably aware, sir, since council schools are now compulsory, that the earth is in possession of two poles.
Yes, sir. Of this, I was aware.
And that this orb on which we live is not a genuine sphere. It is, in fact, flattened ever so slightly at the poles, much like this creature I hold in my hand. Can you identify it, Mr. Jones?
I would say it's a seer.
Exactly. Our country's educational system has not failed as I so suspected. It is a sea urchin, a common echinus. Nature repeats herself in many forms regardless of size. You will agree.
Yes, I imagine so.
Precisely. And this simple echinus is a model, a prototype of this world. Objections?
A living creature. It needs food. Where could the world sustain its huge body?
Ah, excellent point. Excellent. Again, we turn to our little friends, the echinus. The water that surrounds it flows through the tubes of this small creature and provides it nutrition. So, like water, is the very ether in which the earth browses upon its circular path. As it moves, the ether is continually pouring through and providing it vitality.
Did I say barking mad before? No. No, howling. Howling mad.
Quite a flock of other little world echini are doing the same thing. Venus, Mars, and the rest, each with his own field for grazing.
As I said, howling to the hilltops, calling down the moon, mad. I was stunned to silence. The silence the professor took as agreement.
We will then suppose that on this outer hard rind are found certain infinitely small insects crawling upon the surface. Question, would the echinus ever be aware of their existence?
I should hope not.
Oh, you can well imagine then that the earth has not the least idea of the way in which it is utilized by the human race. It is quite unaware of this fungus, growth of vegetation, and evolution of tiny animalcules collected upon it during its travels around the sun as barnacles gather upon the ancient vessel. That is the present state of affairs, and that is what I propose to alter.
Alter?
I propose to let the Earth know that there is at least one person, George Edward Challenger, who calls for attention, who indeed insists upon attention. It is certainly the first intimation it has ever had of the sort.
And how, sir, will you do this?
There, we get down to business. You have touched the spot. I will again call your attention to this interesting little creature that I hold in my hand. It is all nerves and sensibility beneath that protective crust. Now, is it not evident that if a parasitic animalcule desired to call its attention, it would sink a hole in its shell and so stimulate its sensory apparatus?
Certainly.
Or again, we will take the case of the homely flea or mosquito that explores the surface of the human body. We may be unaware of its presence, but presently, when it sinks its proboscis through the skin, which is our crust, we are disagreeably reminded that we are not altogether alone. My plans now will no doubt begin to dawn upon you. Light breaks in the darkness.
You propose to sink a shaft through the Earth's crust.
Sunk? Past tense, sir. Several months of constant work, which has been carried on night and day, conducted by every known species of drill, borer, crusher, and explosive.
My word.
The last stage has now been reached, and the last stage calls for none other than you, Mr. Peerless Jones. You, sir, represent the mosquito. Your artesian borer takes place of the stinging proboscis, a metal proboscis as sharp as possible, not more than 100 feet in length and operated by an electric motor.
Why an electric motor? Especially if at death, why, it will take
a... I am here, Mr. Jones, to give orders, not reasons. Suffice to say that before we finish, it may happen that your very life may depend upon this drill being started from a great distance. It can, I presume, be done.
Yes, certainly it can be done.
Then prepare yourself. The matter is not yet ready for your actual presence, but your preparations may now be made.
But it is essential that you should let me know what soil the drill is to penetrate. Sand, clay, or chalk. Each would need a different treatment.
Let us say gelatinous.
And as abruptly as it began, our interview was ended. Upon returning to my office, I found Ted Malone waiting with a broad grin upon his face.
None the worse, no assault or battery. And what do you think of the old boy?
The most aggravating, insolent, intolerant, self-opinionated man I have ever met. But...
Exactly. We all come to that. But here's what you say a lot more. One feels that so big a man is not to be measured in our scale, and that we can endure him from what we would not stand from any other living mortal. Is that not so?
I'm sure I cannot say other than I find him quite mad.
You say it as if it was a bad thing.
Ted, your fawning frightens me.
Be that as it may, this whole thing is colossal. Colossal in conception and colossal in execution. My advice to you is to get your gear ready. You'll be hearing from him soon enough.
As it happened, it was from Malone I heard. He came round to my office some days later, and by afternoon, we were bound by train to Hengist Down.
Peerless, you've been in a deep state since we left London. Why are you studying so intensely?
Poetry.
Why? Him. No wondering you're such a dour state. I prefer his cab poems myself. Much light affair. Well, I hate to disturb your studies, Peerless, but Professor Challenger wished you to read this once we were underway.
Sir, upon arriving at Hengist Down, you will put yourself at the disposal of Mr. Barfoot, the chief engineer, who is in possession of my plans. We have now experienced certain phenomena in the shaft, at and below the 40,000-foot level, that fully bear out my views as to the nature of this planetary body. Yet some sensational proof is needed before I hope to make an impression upon the torpid intelligence of the modern scientific world.
Amazing, isn't it? The professor had the bottom of the shaft covered with a tarpaulin and gave strict orders that it not be disturbed until your arrival. He said 50 feet of drill should more than suffice.
And why should it not be disturbed?
The professor was concerned any disturbance of the space beneath may cause premature results.
Premature? What on earth could he be anticipating?
Oh, I'm sure we'll find out as soon as your part in this is done.
When we arrived at the station of Storrington, near the northern foot of the South Downs, you can imagine that I was in a state of considerable nervous tension. A weather-worn Vauxhall 30 landaulette was awaiting us and bumped us for 6 or 7 miles over bypaths and lanes, which, in spite of their natural seclusion, were deeply rutted and showed every sign of heavy traffic. Before reaching the rise to Hengist Down, we encountered a cordon across the road. A huge man with a notable cauliflower ear peered into the car.
All right, Mr. Malone. I thought it was them from the American Associated Press.
Oh, they're on the track, are they?
Them today and the Times yesterday. How they're buzzing around proper. Look up there. See that glint from the hill? That's the telescope of the Chicago Daily News, that is. Yeah, they're fair on to us now. I've seen them like the crows along Beacon yonder.
Thanks, Jenkins.
My pleasure, sir.
They're a splendid lot of pig workers we have here, and they're being paid far above ordinary rates. They have to be bachelors and teetotalers and under an oath of secrecy. I don't think there's been any leakage up to now.
Shortly, I made the acquaintance of Mr. Barforth, the engineer in charge.
I expect that you're the artesian engineer. Well, I'm glad you've come, but I don't mind telling you that the responsibility for this thing is getting on my nerves. We work away, and I never know if it's a gush of chalk water, or a seam of coal, or a squirt of petroleum, or even a touch of hellfire that's coming next. We've been spared the last up to now, but you may make the connection for all I know.
Is it hot down there?
Well, it's hot, there's no denying it. And yet maybe it's not hotter than the barometric pressure and the confined space might account for. Of course, the ventilation is awful. We pump the air down, but 2-hour shifts are the most men can do. And they'd be willing lads too.
It was at that moment there came an interruption, and I turned with great joy to see my little three-tonner come rolling and heaving over the grass. And heaped up with my tools and sections of tubing bearing my foreman Peters. The worksite was a wondrous place, on a much larger scale than I had imagined. The spoil banks, which represented the thousands of tons removed, had been built up into a bricked horseshoe shape around a bristle of iron pillars and wheels from which the pumps and lifts were operated. They connected with a power building that filled up the gap of the horseshoe. Beyond lay the open mouth of the shaft, a huge, yawning pit some 30 feet in diameter, lined and topped with brick and cement. I craned my head over and gazed down into the dreadful abyss.
Quite a feat, is it not?
8 miles, you say? Wait, what's that dot of light in the darkness?
Oh, that's one of the cages coming up. It's a mile or more from us, but that gleam you see is from an arc lamp. It travels rather quickly. It should be here in a few moments.
Sure enough, the pinpoint of light became larger and larger until it flooded the tube with its silvery radiance, and I had to turn away my eyes from the blinding glare. A moment later, the iron cage clashed up and onto the landing stage. Four men exited.
I suppose the best thing we can do is go down. Then you'll be able to judge the situation for yourself.
Malone led me to an annex to the engine house, where we found a number of baggy suits made of lightweight material. We stripped down and put on the suits together with a pair of rubber-soled slippers. Malone then led us to the cage. Inside was latticed steel, and in the company of Barforth, the chief engineer, We shot down into the bowels of the earth.
There are a series of automatic lifts, each with its own operation station hallowed out of the shaft wall. It's more like travelling by British Rail than the deliberate fall you experience by British lift, eh?
Yes, indeed.
I'm no geologist, Peerless, but if you look quick, you see a veritable potpourri of rock beds.
Yes, that's the lower chalk layer. And those coffee-coloured layers are the Hastings beds. Then the light Ashburnham beds, and into the dark carboniferous clays.
Yeah, like we're descending through time.
For not the flesh of a living creature.
And as we reach our destination, you'll see a band after band of jet black sparkling coal.
As we passed below the coal beds, I was conscious of jumbled strata of concrete-like material where quartz crystals gleamed and twinkled as if the dark walls were sown with the dust of diamonds. Still we descended. Down, and ever down we went. Lower now than ever mortals had before penetrated. The air got ever closer and hotter until even our lightweight garments were intolerable, and the sweat was pouring down into those rubber-soled slippers, and just as I was thinking I could stand the descent no more...
End of the line, then.
We stepped out upon the circular platform. I noted how Malone gave a curiously suspicious glance around the rock walls. Now, if I did not know him to be among the bravest of men, I would have suspected him of being exceedingly nervous.
Have a look here, Mr. Jones. See this here funny-looking stuff? Glistens. Glistens like pond scum it does. There have been shiverings and tremblings down here. I don't know what we're dealing with, but the professor seemed pleased with it. But this is all new to me.
I'm bound to say I've seen that wall fairly shake itself. Last time I was down here, we fixed those two crossbeams for your drill. When we cut into the strata to sink the supports, it seemed to wince at every stroke of the hammer. I tell you, Peerless, the old man's theory seems absurd in solid old London town. But down here, 8 miles under the surface, I'm not so sure.
If you saw what was under that tarpaulin, you'd be even less sure. All this lower rock cut like cheese. And when we were through, we came to our new formation like nothing on earth. As soon as he laid eyes on it, the professor threw up a great row. Cover it! Cover it! Don't touch it, he screamed.
Can we have a look?
Not a joke, disobeying the professor. You know this, Mr. Malone. And so damn cunning, too. But you never know what cheek he has set for you.
Barford turned down the reflector lamp so that the light gleamed upon the black tarpaulin, and, stooping, seized the rope connected to the corner.
Oh my gosh.
But it was the most extraordinary, terrifying sight. The floor consisted of some grayish material, glazed and shiny. It rose and fell in a slow palpitation, throbs that gave the impression of a gentle rhythm or ripple that ran across the surface. We all stood spellbound, gazing at the extraordinary sight.
It does look rather like a skinned animal. The old man may be not so far out with his blessed echinus.
Good Lord. Am I to plunge a harpoon into that?
That's your privilege, my son. To be sure, I'll be standing behind you when you do it.
Well, I won't. He's never clearer on anything than I am on that. The old man insists. Then I resign my portfolio.
Good Lord. Look at that. To our astonishment, the gray surface gave a sudden heave upwards, welling towards us as a wave does when viewed from the bulwarks. And suddenly as it arose, it subsided, and the dim beating and throbbing continued as before.
Yes. It seemed almost as if it knew we were here. Why should it swell up toward us? Perhaps the light has some effect on it. Let me recover it.
And what am I expected to do now?
The professor's idea was to use your 6-inch bore and fasten it in some way between those supports that we built.
It was as one might imagine. The strangest experience of a very varied life that has included wells sinking in every continent upon Earth. Professor Challenger was insistent that the operation should be started from a distance, Ted. And I begin to see a good deal of sense in that contention.
Electric control will not be an issue as the tunnel is wired from top to bottom.
We brought down our lengths of tubing and stacked them on the rocky ledge. It was difficult work in the night, tropical heat, and that ever-present feeling that a slip of a foot or the dropping of a tool upon the tarpaulin beneath us might bring about some inconceivable catastrophe. We were awed, too, by our surroundings. Again and again, I saw strange quiver and shiver pass down through the walls. None of us were very sorry when we signal the lift to the surface and report our readiness to Professor Challenger. Once we returned to the surface, there was nothing but to wait until the appointed day.
From Professor G.E. Challenger, FRS, MD, DSC, etc., late president of the Zoological Institute and holder of so many honorary degrees and appointments that they overtax the capacity of this meager card. Requests your attendance, 11:30 a.m. on Tuesday, June 21st, to witness a remarkable triumph of mind over matter at Hengistown, Sussex.
It is mere swank sending an invitation to us. We have to be there whatever happens.
So says the hangman to the accused.
This has set all London buzzing. The old man is where he likes to be. The pinpoint limelight right on his hairy old head.
And so at last, the great day came. Our borer was fixed in position, the weight adjusted with the electric controls designed to be operated from the surface at a point some 500 yards from the mouth of the shaft.
It's an ideal English day, that's for sure.
Looks as though the whole world is here.
Aye, it's a mite like Epsom Downs on Derby Day.
Am I mistaken, or have they roped off certain areas within the compound down there?
That they have. They've got various privileged people in a particular pen higher up the slope. Another for peers, one for members of the House of Commons, one for the heads of the learned societies, and men of fame in the scientific world. They've even got a reserved enclosure with sandbags and a corrugated iron roof for three members of the royal family.
At a quarter past 11, a fanfare was heard. And Professor Challenger stood by his enclosure at the peak of the down, resplendent in his frock coat, white waistcoat, and burnished top hat. His expression, a blend of overpowering and almost offensive benevolence, mixed with the most portentous self-importance.
By now you are familiar with my theories pertaining to the Earth as a living, breathing entity. To that end, I have sunk a shaft through the crust of the Earth, and I am about to try the effect of a vigorous stimulation of its sensory cortex. A delicate operation that will be carried out by my subordinates, Mr. Peerless Jones and Mr. Edward Malone. The exposed and sensitive substance will be pricked, as it were, and how it will react is a matter of conjecture. Now, if you will kindly please take your seats. These two gentlemen will descend into the pit and make final adjustments. I will then press the electric button on this table, and the experiment will be complete.
Why do I feel the one about to have his hide pierced? 20 minutes later, we were back at the bottom of the shaft. The air was close and hotter than a boiling cauldron. As I readied the electricals, Malone pulled back the tarpaulin.
It's It's as though this great beast knows the liberty that's about to be attempted. This is by some strange cosmic telepathy.
The exposed surface had become like a boiling pot. Great gray bubbles rose, bursting at the report. A dark purple fluid appeared through the bubbles. The throb of life was in it all, and a heavy smell made the air hardly fit for human lungs.
My God, Jones! Look there! The walls are expanding!
Come on, Ted. This may be a race for our lives. I'd not wager reaching the surface before this shaft collapses.
The Academy of Sciences will tread lightly about Challenger from this day forward.
I fear it will be the whole human race who treads lightly. The walls were indeed throbbing and pulsing in sympathy. This movement had reacted upon the holes in which the life support beams rested, and it was clear that with a very little retraction, the beams would fall. We had to reach the surface before that happened.
I don't fancy being 8 miles down when this great beast convulses just enough to collapse this shaft. I've got the pulley turbine at full throttle.
At this point, I would swear to you my heart pulsed in time with the walls about us.
Oh, that. I've lived to see the day, Peerless. Challenger's proven himself worthy of this attention, but he's gambit for sure.
Perhaps all too literally, Ted. He's proven his case, but as a man of science, should he have not foreseen the consequences?
Is it really the time to be philosophical, Peerless?
Oh, the professor was right. This world is indeed a living entity. Once this task is complete and our presence is made known, will she be so willing to suffer our company as before?
If this great beast is indeed our mother, as the poets say, she should applaud us as her greatest achievement, should she not?
Minutes seemed like hours as we shot for the surface. At each landing stage, we'd spring out and jump into the next lift, throw the release and fly upwards. Finally, through the steel latticed roof, we could see the little circle of light that marked the mouth of the shaft.
I do believe I see a veritable light at the end of the tunnel. Peerless!
Then at last, in a mad moment of pure joy and thankfulness, we threw open the gate and sprang out of our bosom. We'd not gone 30 paces from the lift when from far down in the depths, my iron dot shot into the nerve ganglion of old Mother Earth and Challenger's great moment arrived. What was it happened? Neither Malone nor I was in a position to say, for both of us were swept off our feet as by a cyclone and swirled along the grass, revolving round and round like two curling stones upon an ice rink. At the same time, our ears were assaulted by the most horrible cry that ever yet was heard. It was at this moment, I believe, I lost all wits and must needs rely on others for adequate description of what transpired next.
Who is there, of all the hundreds who attempted it, has ever yet adequately described that terrible cry?
It was a howl in which pain, anger, menace, and the outraged majesty of nature all blended into one hideous shriek.
Minute it lasted, 1,000 sirens in one, paralyzing the great multitude with its fierce insistence.
It floated away through the still summer air until it went echoing along the whole south coast, even reaching our French neighbors across the channel.
No sound in history equaled the cry of the injured earth.
The sound came the fury.
The first emergence from the bounds of the earth consisted of the list cages, like darts from a blowgun. So the 14 lift cages appeared one after the other, each soaring in a glorious parabola that landed each of them in turn near the sea, near the wood.
Spectators have averred that of all the strange sights that they had ever seen, nothing could exceed that of the 14 lift cages serenely sailing through the blue heavens.
Then came the geyser. It was an enormous spout of vile, treacle-like substance, the consistency of tar. It shot up into the air to a height of 2,000 feet. An inquisitive aeroplane that had been hovering over the scene was picked off as by armed rocket and made a forced landing. Man and machine mattered in filth.
This horrible stuff, which had a most penetrating and nauseous odor, may have represented the lifeblood of the planet. Or maybe, as Professor Giesinger at the Berlin School maintains, a protective secretion analogous to that of a skunk.
Which nature has provided in order to defend Mother Earth from intrusive challengers.
If that were so, the prime offender, seated on his throne on the peak of the down, escaped untarnished.
While the unfortunate press were soaked and saturated, having been seated in the direct line of fire, as were the representatives from the House of Commons.
Due to the sturdy iron roofing of their enclosure, however, the members of the royal family were spared.
But due to the tenacity of the odoriferous ichors, none was capable of entering decent society for many weeks.
There were no casualties. No home was left desolate, but many were made quite odoriferous and still carry within their walls some of that souvenir of that great occasion.
But all was not concluded, for then came the closing of the pit. As nature slowly closes the wound from below upwards, so did the earth, but with extreme rapidity.
Circled the shaft opening, flattened out and crashed together, while a tremor, a small earthquake, shook down the spoil banks and piled a pyramid of 50 feet high of debris, broken iron, over the spot.
Professor Challenger's experiment was not only finished, it was buried from human sight forever. If it were not for the obelisk, later erected by the Royal Society, I doubt our descendants would ever know the exact site of this remarkable occurrence.
For a long moment afterward, a hush of tense stillness settled over the matted crowd. People struggled to reassemble their wits and tried to realize what exactly had occurred and how it had come about.
With one impulse, they turned upon Challenger. From every part of the down there came cries of admiration, and from his hillock he could look down upon the lake of upturned faces. Broken only by the rise and fall of waving handkerchiefs, he rose from his chair, his eyes half closed, a smile of conscious merit upon his face, his left hand upon his hip, his right buried within the breast of his frock coat.
Surely that picture was fixed forever, for we heard the cameras clicking.
The June sun shone golden upon him as he turned, gravely bowing. Challenger, the super scientist. Challenger, the arch pioneer. Challenger, the first of all men whom Mother Earth has been compelled to recognize.
Astounding, eh, Peerless? And you were here to experience it. Astounding.
And now that we have her attention, what's to be done with it? For the first time in the progress of the professor's mad experiment, I felt a sense of shuddering dread. Challenger had not only attracted Mother Earth's attention, but he had proven her vulnerable to harm, as vulnerable as you or I. A truism I doubt even the professor had foreseen. This small blue orb is as fragile as the petty insects that scurry over her surface. And the words of the poet return to mind. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but a...
Been listening to an American Radio Theater presentation of When the World Screamed, written by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and adapted by Cole Hornaday. It was produced by Joy Jackson and directed by David Van Meter. In our cast, you heard Ivan Curry as Peerless Jones,
Cole Hornaday as Professor Challenger, Dr. Robert Perks as Ted Malone, Pat McNally as Jack Devonshire, David Parker as Chief Engineer Barforth. Also in the cast, Julie Hoverson, Melinda Maines, and Esther Geddes McVeigh. Recorded sound effects by Cole Hornaday and Joy Jackson. Live sound effects by Penny Swanberg, Marilyn Wilt, and Ryan Park. I'm Joy Jackson. This is ART, the American Radio Theater. Gee, that's all the time I've got for today. Please have a look at our website, www.americanradiotheater.org, and see what else we've got posted as podcasts. Over to you, Louise.
Okay, Joy. Thanks a lot. And I will take it from here. Well, folks, that is just about going to do it. So we are going to wrap things up and shut things down for this week's broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. But don't worry, we will be back again next week. You know where and you know when. If you have any questions, comments, complaints, or maybe even a request or two, please address them via email to michaemeli@earthlink.net. That's michaemeli@earthlink.net. We will soon be releasing the key and returning the room to you, the listening audience. Please do with it as you wish for as long as you wish. But just remember, be nice to one another. On behalf of myself and the rest of the MSS crew, have a great night, a great weekend, and goodbye.